It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Smockin'. You know, sometimes it's nice just to mix things up a little bit. Cofefe? Yeah. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. We begin a brand new broadcast week here on the Horn. The second broadcast week of December 2018 as we look at 2018 and say, no, it's been nice. It's been nice. No. I hear your mom calling. Yeah, got to get going. Wouldn't want to be late. Long trip to January. Goodbye now. Right. Yeah. This is the Horn. Headon.live is where we exist online. Among other things, Brother Deacon Asa recently installed a Who's This Mathingy that'll show you my Twitter feed over there at Headon.live. If you'd care to keep up with it that way, you're more than welcome to. Just run on over to Headon.live, click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and jump right into the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place in the hours in which this program is live from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you do so right now, you'll be greeted by the likes of Anatole and Urban Prospector and V.T. Blom and more who will be wandering along presently and, of course, capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has, in fact, folded space early December afternoon to become Man Cave. Yes. We had a little sunshine here today. It was that southeastern snowstorm. We caught the very top edge of it. Beckley was a freaking mess. But over here, we just got a couple of inches on the ground, and turned out to be a great day to be playing with the acorn smoker. For those of you interested, you can go over to my Facebook page or Instagram. Hillbilly Elitist on Instagram. I don't know if it's on Twitter or not, but you can see. Oh, wow, it was good. Agnes was really, really proud. I got a giveaway price on a pork loin, and we cut it differently, and I stuffed the thing with brandied dried fruit and brie and shredded Dubliner cheese. Are you there, Todd? Can you hear me, man? Are you salivating? And rolled that sucker up. Learned to tie a butcher's knot, tie up a roast. It had been brined in with cinnamon and allspice and nutmeg and cloves and orange peel, and roasted it for a little while, and then wrapped it up, and oh, God, it was good. It was fan-freaking-tastic, and I'm usually kind of agnostic about pork loins because they have a tendency to get really, really dry, but oh, this one stayed moist and juicy and wonderful. And so I got to play outside yesterday, and me getting to play outside is very, very important because that's kind of how I stay sane. And as we move into the teeth of winter, those days will become rarer and rarer and rarer. But darn, it sure is fun when it can happen. So that's what I did. That's what I did with my Sunday. What'd y'all do? What's that, Marty? Marty says, need a taste tester for that loin? Send it this way. I'd love to, Marty, but the sucker's gone. No, Randy, I did not get to Beckley because Beckley has been a hot mess. I was talking to Boss Man Wayne earlier today, and I'll be there either tomorrow or the next day. Kind of depending on how, since we're talking about it, kind of depending on how fundraising works out. Because we enter the program this evening in a $515 hole. And that's just how it is. But we have thanks to send out. Thanks to our subscribers to send out. Thank you very kindly back on Saturday to Ron in the far frozen north. Thank you very kindly to Tom. And thanks very much indeed to Marcia. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you very much to Nancy. Nancy is much appreciated. Much appreciated, Brendan. Thank you, Brendan. And thank you very kindly to Dwayne. Thank you. Thank you all for being partial sponsors of the program. Then along came Sunday, to wit, yesterday, and thanks go out to our buddy of long standing, Khalil, for helping keep the program on the air, and to Kathleen. Thank you, Kathleen, so very, very much indeed. And then today, the 10th of the month, we have thanks to send out to Don, buddy from way back. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Daniel. And thank you very kindly to Judy. Those are our three subscribers for the 10th day of the month. And, of course, a general reminder, if you'd like to be a subscriber, you know, you're going to be knocking yourself out to the tune of about less than 16 cents an hour per programming. And I realize that can be tough, but if you take the whole program together, you're still not even quite out half of a McDonald's hamburger per day. And, well, damn, I keep looking around up at the Rippy Mart trying to find something for 16 cents. I haven't found it yet. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to quit looking, so I can at least compare it. But we're looking at less than a fifth of a McDonald's hamburger per hour and less than half of a McDonald's per hamburger per program, okay? So that's how that works. But if you'd like to be a subscriber, run right over. You can either click Patreon or you can click PayPal. Either one's fine. Patreon comes out on the first of the month. And by the way, a big thanks to go out at the beginning of the program. Also, to the we finished the week last week at -360, and it could have been it's not -360 now, including this evening. It's -515, but helping us to get down from that 60 that 60 buck level, there's Daniel. Thank you, Daniel, very, very kindly, and thanks as well to let me scroll down here for just a confounded minute. Nope, got to go back up. Oh, thank you to Catherine. Yes, thank you to Catherine. So, all taken all together, Catherine and Daniel managed to get us down to 315 from last week and then 200 from today. So, 515. 515 is where we stand. I hate to talk about this all the time. One of these days, maybe I won't have to. And thank you very kindly to our buddy Glenn up in New York, who just took us down to 505. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you so very, very much indeed. And you're right. Marty says, 16 cents isn't a whole lot of gasoline either in this state. Not much over here either. We're running about $2.60 a gallon right now. I know. Already Robert in Australia is going, don't do that, Bob. Don't talk about you. And meanwhile, over in France, the Gilets Jaunes, would probably laugh very gallically at the idea of paying $2.60 for a gallon of gasoline, which works out to, let's see, 4 into 26, 20, it works out to about 65, around probably 67, 70 cents a liter. And no, they're not paying anything like that over there. And we might, we'll probably talk about that just a little bit. I had a great email from our buddy Mike in Cascadia earlier today that I thought bore sharing. It's Moran Monday, of course, and hopefully, well, look, here's the skinny. The reason we fundraise like we do is to keep this on the air. I wish I had a rich uncle or something like that, but I don't. And so consequently, this is how we keep the program on the air and have for a lot of years now. But the bills come due every month. And right now, we're looking at, let's see, power bill's about $300. there's that clean coal-fired electricity some more. And then other, all told, we got about $600 worth of bills that are due like right now. And we need to raise $505 more bucks this evening. So there's that. Let's see here. Where was I going? Oh, yeah. Anyway, over at the website, headon.live, the PayPal button is there. And if you want to help out, that's how this program is here every evening when you expect it to be here. I wish I could run it on good looks. Well, I couldn't run it on good looks, but maybe we could run it on Agnes's beauty, but certainly not mine. But it doesn't work that way either, and I have yet to, let's just say Appalachian Power and I are not good friends. Yeah, coal, fired electricity and whatnot and all that. But anyway, like I said, I had a great note earlier today from Mike in Cascadia, subject line, Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests. Mike says, "Hey, Bob." "Hey, Mike. Since my wife and I visited Paris in mid-October, I've watched with particular interest the Gilets Jaunes protests in Paris and other locations across France. This was our first visit to Paris, and we fell in love with the city. Hard not to. From the architecture to the art to the cafes, we were blown away. To prepare for our trip, I read Hemingway's A Movable Feast and Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities." Good call in both instances, but I wonder how much of either one's Paris yet remains. But some does, because Mike points out, while there, we made a point of visiting Hemingway's first residence, and we visited the Conciergerie, the last stop before the guillotine for prisoners of the French Revolution. We saw much art, from the massive Louvre to the intimate Orsay Museum with Gauguin, Monet, Matisse, Renoir, and Van Gogh, to the Rodin Museum with Le Penseur, and finally to the Picasso Museum with his sculptures and paintings. The humanity and history captured by the art and everything there fills up the soul. I have never seen the Louvre, and I can tell you that I certainly would love to someday. Mike continues, "While we were in Paris, and right now at this time with Gilets Jaunes, a word I learned from you, abattoir, has stuck in my mind. At the Conciergerie, there is a memorial to the 4,000-plus souls slaughtered by the French Revolution. On the tip of the Ile de l'Esté, we visited the Deportation Martyrs Memorial, a tribute to the hundreds of thousands of French Jews, gypsies, gays, and others sent to the ovens by the Nazis in World War II. Lately, in one of his columns, Charlie Pierce referenced St. Bartholomew's massacre in 1572 Paris. Wasn't familiar with the St. Bartholomew's massacre, so I looked it up. Turns out the Catholics murdered several thousand Protestants in Paris and across France in those days, a litany of abattoirs across time. You know, those would be the Huguenots. I don't know. Gilets Jaunes, Mike continues, may have started as a legitimate protest against inequality in France, but it has morphed into something entirely different as evidenced by their stated goals, including leaving the EU and NATO, defaulting on public debt, less immigration, a new constitution, and cutting taxes. That sounds like somebody else's agenda, he said editorially. Over this past weekend, I saw progressives on Twitter cheering for Gilets Jaunes, and I saw maggots screaming, "Make France Great Again." Mufga. Josh Fox, who I've met and admire, was fighting over Gilets Jaunes with Neera Tanden on Twitter. He essentially called her a neoliberal establishment shill for pointing out that the Gilets Jaunes goals are right-wing and supported by Putin. In fact, hundreds of Russian bots were spreading anti-Macron propaganda under the hashtag Gilets Jaunes. Furthermore, polling in France demonstrates that the majority of Gilets Jaunes protesters are right-wing and only 20% are identified as left-wing. It is a fact that Putin's goals include the weakening of Western liberal democracies and various alliances amongst those countries. Wise men in the United States established the framework and bulwark of our alliances that have prevented human slaughterhouses, abattoirs, in Europe since 1945. Supporting Gilets Jaunes and its goal of weakening the West is irresponsible and dangerous. It is myopic for progressives to support Gilets Jaunes, and we must remind ourselves loudly what is at stake. Paris is full of reminders of abattoirs past. Much truth there, much truth indeed, and thank you for taking the time to share it, Mike. I really appreciate it. There's another word that might come to mind as well. And since Mike mentioned the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, now that's in the, the 1570s. Well, a couple of hundred years before that, there were, it's one of those things that's almost endemic to European peasantry. Every now and then they get pissed off and they rise up, and then the moneyed classes, the wealth classes, the religion classes, they would rise up in turn and slaughter the daylights out of the peasants and put them back in their place. Every now and then the peasants get completely out of hand, though, and that's why there's no that's why there's no King of France.
Off with his head.
Right. But if you look back to the late 1300s, you will find an uprising of another, and this is another French term, you'll find uprisings by the les jacqueries, which is a way of saying, it's kind of the way we talk about the Cleti collective, the Cletuses, the jacqueries, bunch of Jacques. And they rose up in Paris, blocked streets, and the next thing you know, there are heavily armed men on horses riding through, slaughtering the bejesus out of them. Happens. Because the feudal system was so damn brutal, especially as the Middle Ages, medieval period, came to its ignominious end, largely on the heels of the Black Death. But I haven't talked a lot about the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests, because I've been trying to gather as much information to myself as I possibly could, simply because it didn't seem as simple as it was being presented. I think a lot of us were seduced, the right word, by the fact that Emmanuel Macron appeared to be a capable foil against Julius Caesar. And we sort of defaulted to that general easily adopted notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, Emmanuel Macron is no socialist, and he's certainly not a friend of the working people of France. He's filthy rich, comes from a corporatist industrialist background, and took one look at the French economy and said, "Ah, sacré bleu! Look at all these peasants eating all this food. Look at all these things that we are spending our money upon that we could be putting into corporate profits, eh? Ho, ho, ho." Twirling my little mustache here even as we speak. And so he went after things that matter to the French middle class with the real gusto. And yes, before you can even get it typed, either Ron and Raleigh or Brother Deacon Asa, yes, that is that's old cousin Francois Kincaid. Yes. But the other side of this is, and it's scary, is that of course Macron defeated who to become president of France? That's right. He defeated a goddamn fascist. Sure enough, no kidding, Vichy wannabe fascist in Marine Le Pen. And so now Les Gilets Jaunes are out there marching around demanding the resignation of Emmanuel Macron, which he's not going to do. But a whole bunch of them are pissed off Le Pen fascist wannabes, or outright fascists. Jesus, I had no idea. Brother Deacon Asa said, did you know, and he's talking about Vancouver, did you know we had our own Gilets Jaunes protests here calling for Trudeau? No, maybe he's talking about, are you talking about Vancouver? You got a little more clarity here, Asa. Did you know we had our own Gilets Jaunes protests here calling for Trudeau's severed head over the weekend? The Nazis are en marche, Brother Bob. En marche. Marchant, marchant. Nope, wrong song, wrong time. But the fact of the matter is, it all started over a fuel tax that Emmanuel Macron had said was necessary to battle climate change. Okay, so yes, in Vancouver. Thank you, Asa. That's kind of wild. The fuel tax, of course, as any regressive tax does, hit the people with the least amount of money the hardest. That's why progressive taxation is so much such a much better idea. Because you're not deliberately screwing the people who can least afford to take the screwing. But it was also an object lesson in the difficulty we are going to have as a species facing up to the realities of climate change. It's very easy to talk about in the abstract. It's a lot harder to accomplish in the real world. And in point of fact, there's a good example of that coming from the UN climate talks that were held in Poland, COP24. And lo and behold, they've been held in Katowice, Poland. I don't know what to do with that W. Is that a V or a W? God, it helped me. But we showed up. The coal industry showed up with lots of propaganda and bullshit, touting how wonderful coal is. And of course, it wasn't lost on anybody that Poland, the country hosting the meeting, is the largest producer of what the article I'm looking at Think Progress refers to as hard coal. I don't know if they mean anthracite or not lignite. Poland gets 80% of its energy from coal. And it's second only to, and this is going to be a shock, Germany, in consumption of fossil fuels within the scope of the European Union. Poland, for instance, during winter, has horrible air quality. And if you are a longtime listener to this program, you know that it's the poisons that coal puts in the air far more than anything affecting the water that brings on the statistical excess deaths that that plague any country that relies upon coal. And so there they were, the coal industry, the global coal industry, pushing coal for all they were worth in Poland. Not a good sign. Not in the least. On the other hand, protesters were ready. At one point, they shut down one presentation, and began preaching their own message. Now, the regime of Julius Geyser sent a guy by the name of Steve Weinberg. He's Assistant Secretary at the Department of Energy. And Wells Griffith, Senior Director for Energy at the National Security Council. There was a pro-coal representative from the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs. And then there were representatives for natural gas, fracking, nuclear energy. And Wells Griffith got things going by saying the following. Remember, this is Morian Monday. If we're serious about eradicating poverty, and the minute I see that, I know where it's going, because I heard Don Blankenship squealing this filth years ago. If we're serious about eradicating poverty, it is clear that energy innovation and fossil fuels will continue to play a leading role. That's when the crowd started laughing at him openly. Most of the crowd were activists and journalists anyway. And the event hosted by the U.S. Was disrupted with the activists chanting, "Keep it in the ground." And this is one of those proud moments. A whole bunch of the activists there were indigenous Americans. And they had gone all the way to Poland to make it clear that they were not willing to be sacrificed for the profits of some godforsaken coal or oil baron. Eventually, authorities came and led these Native Americans and other activists away as they shouted, "Shame on you," at the coal, oil, and gas, what will we call them, enthusiasts, who care not a tinker's damn about the ability of this planet to support human life, because they haven't yet figured out that their money isn't real without other people to make it real, and that they don't hook U-Hauls up to hearses. Yeah, that's a good one. Steve in New York pointing out, "I can't wait to see healthy low-tar cigarettes presentation at a meeting of the World Health Organization." That's the rough equivalent of having coal at an environmental conference. Jean Sue is the energy director at the Center for Biological Diversity. That organization issued a statement in which she said, "Once again, Trump's team came to the UN climate summit to hawk dirty fossil fuels from the sidelines. The panel ignored the scientific reality that we need to rapidly transition to clean energy instead of promoted climate suicide." And among other things, they rejected, well, not they. Here, let's make sure we've got this really, really nailed down. When it came time to adopt the UN Intergovernmental Panel Climate Change report, the one we were talking about that came out at the end of October. Well, the United States nixed that report, but not just the United States. Oh, hell no. The United States, in conjunction with some of our best and dearest friends, it was commissioned, you might recall it, by the 2015 climate conference. And the report, as we discussed it, says that as it is, we're leaning toward a 3 degree Celsius temperature rise globally this century rather than 1.5 that the report and the group agreed we needed to keep right. And among other things, carbon dioxide emissions would have to be cut by 45% by 2030. Well, at the COP24 meeting in Poland, our dear, dear, dear friends the Saudis and the Russians and the Kuwaitis linked arms with Merca, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth now, today, in the universe, forever under God, and objected to the acceptance of the IPCC report. And because no one, and because the United States and the Saudis and the Russians and the Kuwaitis wouldn't budge an inch under the rules the United Nations established for this meeting and for the passage of text in reports, the report had to be ditched, dropped, dumped. Rowena Haynes from St. Kitts and Nevis said, "It's not about one word or another. It is us being in a position to welcome a report we commissioned in the first place. If there's anything ludicrous about the discussion, it's that we can't welcome the report." Yamide Dagnet of the World Resources Institute, formerly a climate negotiator for the UK, said, "We are really angry and find it atrocious that some countries dismiss the messages and the consequences that we are facing. Not by accepting what is unequivocal and not, or rather what we are facing, by not accepting what is unequivocal and not acting upon it." Camilla Bourne from the climate think tank E3G said, climate science is not a political football. All the world's governments, Saudi included, agreed the 1.5 degrees Celsius report, and we deserve the truth. Saudi can't argue with physics. The climate will keep on changing. Yamide Dagnet also said, "We hope that the rest of the world will rally and we get a decisive response to the report. I sincerely hope that all countries will fight, that we don't leave COP24 having missed a moment of history." Well, I understand the language, a moment of history, but this ain't history. History's something that happened some other, in the past. What we're talking about is the real-world implications for real human beings of our failure to act. It may not feel like it's one of those things, but it is. In the wake of the campfire in California, an insurance company an insurance company that had something on the order of $64 million in fire-related claims, well, it just went belly up. They had $64 million in claims, but they only had about $23 million in assets. Talking about the Merced County Insurance Company. And the vast majority of their clients are in the Sacramento Central Valley area. And they said, look, the claim's been made. We can't pay them. We're done. And on the third day of December, a judge... Gave the okay to the liquidation proceedings. They noted they expected $64 million in outstanding liabilities in Paradise, and there was no way they were going to be able to pay them. But not to fear, because California has some of those job-killing regulations. Mm-hmm. They have something called the California Insurance Guarantee Association, which will pick up the outstanding claims. This was a bit of enlightened forethought on the part of California state government to make sure that people wiped out by a disaster won't be wiped out twice by the fact that their insurance company starts pining for the fjords. There's only one hitch. The California Insurance Guarantee Association may not be able to pay the entirety of the claims of the people who got stiffed by their insurance company. And insurance companies going belly up are kind of not real frequent, because they're supposed to be insurance companies, and they're supposed to be able to have assets sufficient to meet their liabilities. But in a world that is changing as a result of climate change, they don't. Probably none of them do. Here's a number that'll make your liver quiver. Uh, 15 major U.S. insurers have said that in the last year, natural disasters have cost them around $14.5 billion with a B, billion dollars. And these companies, which are largely headed by Republicans, but are headed by Republicans who aren't in office and therefore have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders or their owners, in the case of closely held corporations, those millionaires don't have any problem acknowledging the reality of climate change, because they know that that's why their costs are going through the damn roof. And here's the thing. Those insurance company executives, they expect matters to continue getting worse. And that's kind of, I would think, you know, sobering. On the other hand, as far as government is concerned, we're clueless. Between 1990 and 2010, 20 years, 43% of new homes built all over the United States were built in places that are increasingly likely to be impacted by wildfires. This past January, almost a year ago, one insurance regulator in California said the fact that the wildfires are happening more often and more intensely is making it harder for homeowners to get and keep homeowners insurance coverage. And then, of course, maybe maybe your insurance company only has $23 million worth of assets to deal with $64 million in claims. It's just a little insurance company, just a baby one. But again, it's the cockroach rule. If you see one, you got 1,000. And there's no reason to believe that there's an insurance company in this country that has enough money on hand to pay every claim in the case of a massive climate-driven natural disaster. Which that kind of makes it an unnatural disaster, but not an act of God, because that lets the insurance companies cheat and not pay. And then there's a report in Bloomberg. Oh, God, I love it. I love Jake Brakes on a Semi. Did you hear that one? Bloomberg reported that after massive wildfires in 2017, construction permits were still being issued so people could rebuild their homes without any updated building codes to reduce the risk of future fires. And that's not just California. Hey, if you drive along the beach along the Gulf Coast, the development is massive, which in turn makes those barrier islands less likely to be able to do their jobs of protecting the coastline from hurricanes. Everything that got wiped out in the Florida Panhandle will be rebuilt and bigger and badder, so that it can be re-devastated all over again. Climate change is painfully, painfully real. But the royal house of Ibn Saud couldn't give a rat's ass less, because the checks are still clear. And the royal house of Ibn Saud is never going to have to deal with the realities of climate change. They'll just go somewhere better, nicer. Or the Kuwaitis. And then, of course, the Russians. And their little creature, Donald Smocking Gun Trump. Steve in New York says, oh, dear, dear Bob, you're just spouting the tree-hugging liberal agenda of the military and in the insurance companies. Eh, bunch of damn tree-huggers, them military and them insurance companies. I know. Ron in Raleigh says, insurance. Ha! Did the company say thanks for all those premiums? I'll bet the corporate officers go home with all their salaries and bonuses. You know they will, because they're not supposed to suffer. I mean, there's contractual obligations to pay the executives there. Right! Never mind the contractual obligations in exchange. No. But the neat thing is, they're so damn broke that they're kind of immune from suit, too. So, isn't it funny how the legal system lets that all work out? Yeah. Subject line, liver quiver. Bob, stop telling my internal organs what to do. Thank you, Lee. Thank you. You know, we need a Bob stop telling it. We need at least one of those at night. Mm. And, thank you. We just crossed under the $400, under the $500 mark. Thank you very kindly to John. Who, following Glenn, took us down from 505 to 495. If we could get a real groundswell going, it would be super duper excellent, freaking awesome. Because you know, this program requires electricity and internet to continue. So, yeah, that's where they yeah. So we got $495 to go. It would be great if we didn't have. I mean, if we could knock out. Say the rest of last week. if we could finish Friday, Thursday and Friday of last week this evening, that's $295. And then we'd only have the rest of, and then we'd only have this week to deal with tomorrow. Oh, well. But, you know, the button's over there. Thank you, John, and thank you, Glenn, for being such good friends. Thank you very kindly. Yeah, that's a good question. Steve asks, I can't help but ask this in all seriousness. Do you think the Saudis, et cetera, are doing this to actually object, or are they doing this and making Trump go along with them to send a message to the world that Trump and therefore the United States are in their collective pockets? Steve, I don't think the Saudis have to strong-arm Trump or those freaks, any of the freaks associated with him, to make him do nothing in the face of an existential global climate catastrophe. I think this is what the Saudis are doing. The Saudis are buying time. Because the Saudis are building solar farms. The Saudis are investing in battery technologies. And by the time we have to, which was like already, but they're gonna keep pumping and selling oil until they're ready to consolidate their positions in solar and wind. They got a lot of empty, vast, open, arid, otherwise useless desert that has a lot of sun falling on it that they can put to work. Oh, there it is. There it is, a cowbell going out to Michael in Madison. Bob, stop telling us how many Bob stop telling us as we need per night. Oh man, that is, yeah, that's Shakespearean. That's a joke within a joke. That's perfect. Thank you, Michael. And Marty was right there too. You knew this was coming. Bob, stop telling us we need daily Bob, stop telling us emails or segments. Oh, you guys are good. You're just good. I mentioned act of God. Scott in San Diego says, I've wondered about this for years, so I'll ask you. That boilerplate phrase in insurance dealings, act of God, do companies and policyholders actually take that literally? It would appear to require belief, proof of a deity whose activities are capricious and aren't covered on the policy, leaving the customer on the hook. Has use of the phrase ever been tested or challenged in court? They've tried to test it. Years and years ago, a smart-ass lawyer issued summonses for, I think, God, Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, and all of his agents and assigns, and included in that a few random priests and preachers. The court did not look favorably upon it. But act of God, I don't know what an insurance contract looks like, say, in, and I'm not picking on anybody, and I'm not making too much sport, but let's say you've got a pantheistic approach to godness, say, like, oh, India. And, I mean, in India, do contracts of insurance for Muslims have to say God, and contracts of insurance for Hindus, do they have to say gods? Or do you, or is it an act of, an act of Vishnu or an act of Kali or pick one, because I can't imagine it being an act of Ganesh. Ganesh is just too nice a deity. So I don't know. But it's challenged all the time, because any time an insurance company doesn't want to pay, they have an ugly habit of saying, act of God, man. Which just is a translation of we don't pay. Right. I've created a monster. Meanwhile, Steve from Georgia Stan says, Bob, stop telling us how good we are. this thing's going to just begin to roll. Yeah, Arnold just said, yeah, Bob, you beat me to it. The translation is we don't pay. Hey, thank you. Thank you, Ralphs. Ralphs says, okay, I got 10 bucks, and if it's met, I'll put in 10 bucks more. So if anybody wants to pony up 10 bucks, Ralphs will triple it. If there's somebody out there with 10 bucks, Ralphs will turn it into 30. Thank you, Ralphs. Thank you. That would be huge. That would take us down to 465, and we'd be making some progress. Thank you, Ralphs. Thank you so very much for all you do. Flavio tells us that a joke within a joke is a Matryoshka joke. Is that one of those Russian nesting doll thingies? Yeah, I don't know. Flavio also reminds us, going back to the Gilets Jaunes, 42% of Gilets Jaunes voted for Le Pen in the last election, according to at least one researcher. In the lead-up to the French elections in March, I was getting reports of Russian interference in those elections and the efforts of the French intelligence to thwart that. Yeah, the stories were out there. Those efforts were, as elsewhere in the world, being orchestrated through social media accounts that appeared to be bots, bogus. I was reading French papers and watching French television about this. There goes Flavio flaunting his fluency in French. What saved the French is that their electoral laws have teeth. They impose a 48-hour media blackout before the election takes place itself, with huge fines and jail time, and they don't have Citizens United over there. But they do have social media. Oh, they do. And they do have collaborators over there. And Marine Le Pen was cavorting with the Russians and Steve Bannon. So this is serious, and it's not just the enemy is my friend. This is what we're facing. We on the left suck at social media. Bannon and the Russians do not. That's a whole bunch of truth. And so it becomes a matter of who knew when Facebook first came about and it seemed like a viable alternative to the really annoying nature of, what was that Rupert Murdoch thing that came before Facebook? MySpace. But God, it was tailor-made for fraud and assaults on civil society. And Mark Zuckerberg was right there going along with all of it. How's about that, sports fans? Yeah. Hey, big thanks going out just a minute here. Let me get this right. Thank you. Thank you to Megan for jumping in and meeting Ralph's challenge. So that'll take us down to 465. And, well, if we can get down to 200 bucks, that's 265 bucks from now, we'll be that much further. That'll make things considerably better. And we knock down one bill. So thank you, Megan. And thank you, Ralph's. Thank you very much indeed. What's that? An obligatory Star Trek reference from Lee? Your mention of God or gods reminded me of this quote from the Corbomite maneuver. Balak, your recorder marker has been destroyed. You have been examined. Your ship must be destroyed. We make assumption you have a deity or deities or some such beliefs which comfort you. We therefore grant you 10 Earth time periods known as minutes to make preparations. That's true. It was voiced by Ted Cassidy, who also played Lurch. And then when we finally... isn't that the episode where when we finally find out who's behind it? It's Ron Howard's baby brother. Is that the same one, Lee? Yeah. Only he had At first, it was the really scary-looking face of the guy that looks like he's from the painting The Scream. I think so, yeah. And by the way, since it's Moran Monday, I had a great note from Ron and Raleigh at the beginning of the program to share. Subject line, inappropriate? You're probably not aware of the fact that here in Wake County in the midterm elections, we purged all Republicans from all elective office. We removed the 16-year incumbent Sheriff Donnie Harrison and replaced him with a black man. The main reason Sheriff Harrison was removed is that he was taking part in the 287G program, which helps ICE detain undocumented persons. The new sheriff promised to stop complying with the aforementioned program. The reason I'm writing this is that a business owner, remember this is Moran Monday, made some racial slurs against the new sheriff, calling him the N-word, a lowlife, and a schemer. After the new sheriff got wind of this, he requested that the members of the department not frequent the business of the name caller. The business owner that called the new sheriff these names apologized by saying, "Yes, I used the N-word inappropriately, and that was wrong, and I know it's not a word I use in conversation, and I know it's not a word I use in normal conversation." Well, now, it was inappropriate and should never have been spoken. Ron says, "My question is, when is it ever appropriate to call someone the N-word?" Makes you wonder what goes through people's minds, or if they have minds for those thoughts to, you know, go through. So, once again, the racist in question was more than happy to use the word until it began to affect his bottom line. Huh. And somehow or another, I'll bet you the new sheriff is going to wind up being the person at fault in all of this. Never a dull damn moment. Yeah, Randy, Matryoshka, if they're female characters, and Patryoshka, if they're male characters. I forgot about the Patryoshka part. Yes, Arnold, you're right. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. Or, as I believe it was Dan Quayle who once put it this way, it's a terrible thing to have a mind and lose it. Wasn't that Dan Quayle? Oh, the good old days. Yeah, okay, thank you, Lee pointed out. Yes, it was Ron Howard's brother. Balak was an alter ego puppet. Very good, very good. From the trivia department, Scott tells us, Ted Cassidy also worked as a news reporter on a Dallas radio station in 1963 and covered the JFK assassination. I had no idea. I can imagine when the news broke, he probably said something like, "Ugh." Sorry, couldn't help it. Gonna have that from time to time. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, while we're talking about climate change, and I'm grateful, make no mistake, I am grateful for people like Bernie Sanders who continue to insist that this is the existential threat of our time. I appreciate the work of Bill McKibben at 350. And those two appeared with Van Jones and a lot of other folks in a climate change town hall. Before the town hall took place, however, Bernie sat down and had a chat with Naomi Klein of The Intercept. And Bernie didn't pull any punches. He was quite in earnest. Among other things, he said some things that will make the anti-Trump folks feel good. He referred to Donald Trump as, quote, a pathological liar who thinks climate change is a hoax. That's pretty solid and pretty unequivocal. And this is largely an aesthetic observation. But in his conversation with Naomi Klein, he called for, and again, this is a quote, a war against climate change. And I would simply ask the question, have we not had enough failed wars on things that are intangible to prove to us the inefficacy of calling things wars on things? I mean, I realize we're talking about verbal abstractions. But there's nothing abstract about a real, live, honest-to-God, no-kidding war. Real wars leave real bodies lying in bloody pools in the real dirt. Real wars displace in terrifying degree massive numbers of human beings, see Syria, see Yemen. Can we please, as progressives, okay, and liberals, whatever we're calling ourselves, we generally tend toward the anti-war side of the spectrum. And when you think about what an abject failure the war on drugs was, and when you think about the hammer and tongs opposition to the war on poverty that the Republicans have evinced ever since its announcement, God, what all have we had wars on? Anybody want to compile a list? War on drugs, war on poverty, war on illiteracy. And it creates this mental image where we're going to drop some sort of bomb on something. And do you get what I'm trying to say here? Is there no better word in our progressive lexicon than war to describe an effort to achieve a goal and prevent catastrophe? Is the English language so weak, so poor, so destitute for nouns that the only thing we can call one such effort is a fucking war? Have we not had enough of war? Is the reality of climate change itself not sufficiently horrifying in the scope of its ability to create mass migrations, mass displacements, famine, death, disease? I mean, that sounds like a war. And real wars, as we know, as for instance, the United States military, in each and every branch, have long since contemplated, climate change is going to create real wars with real accompanying horrors. When we use the word war on climate change, what we are inadvertently saying, because the goddess of irony misses nothing, is that we might just do exactly the same thing in the other direction, which is the kind of thing that gets people into the streets in Paris over a gasoline tax. I'm sorry, I think about this kind of stuff. Among other things, Naomi Klein asked Bernie why he wanted to do a town hall on climate change. And his answer was not because I'm running for president in 2020. His answer was, we have found that on some of the most important issues facing this country and the world, corporate media, generally speaking, is not there. So what we've done working with progressive media outlets is come together to produce town meetings. What we're saying is you can get around corporate media, you can talk about real issues, and you know what? The American people are prepared to deal with it. And then when he opened up the town hall, he said, tonight we're dealing with what the scientific community tells us is the great crisis facing our planet and facing humanity. That is climate change. Great! That's a perfect description. And it didn't require referring to anything as a war. The hell ever happened to ain't gonna study war no more? Well, there's Flavio. The war on Christmas was an abject failure. Witness goddamn Christmas music all over the town this year. Hey, easy. I like Christmas music. Once a year, I put on Nat King Cole and Johnny Mathis and get all weepy and get it out of my system for the next, 48 weeks. But it's lovely because it's all wrapped up in memory. And cherished times gone by. But Christmas is still here, so apparently they won the war on Christmas. I don't. But you know, that right-wing war on Christmas sure did take a lot of the fun out of Christmas. Damn it. It sure did. It just did. So, if you... I mean, maybe it's okay if we use eliminationist language as long as we're the ones using it. But I can't help noticing eliminationist language. And it's there in all its glory, even if it's a war on climate change. The language remains eliminationist. And I just ask for us to think about these things because, as the Republicans reminded us over and over and over again in the 1990s, words mean things. And, well, that's true. Randy in PA says we've had failed tangible wars, too, and they're a mess, which brings me to the following psychological tirade. The dress uniforms and marching parades are so orderly, neatly pressed, and spit-polished in psychological contrast to what actual wars are really about, which is the slogging through mud, red mist, and burnt guts spilling out onto the pavement. Oh, and you don't actually get extra lives in true war either. No, you certainly don't. And the reason the military likes all that spit and polish and all that costume jewelry and whatnot is because it puts a prettier face on some of the most ugly aspects of human behavior. Yeah, Clint Howard. Thank you. Thank you, Bill, in Allentown. Clint Howard. Yeah, Ron's baby brother. No, Todd. No, Ron did not just call in. Oh, you're being taunted, Ron. Todd wants to hear from you. So, 9 minutes past the hour, $465 to raise to come even with the end of the evening, $265 to finish off last week. So, thanks to Ralphs and Megan and John and Glenn for jumping in here during the program. Thank you very much. Lee in New York says, not calling it war. From my tech background, instead of war, I think of disaster and recovery. Things go wrong. That's called a disaster. Then action is taken to fix the issue and prevent it from recurring. That's called recovery. Climate change is a disaster. All we need now is the recovery. Darlene in Connecticut said, yeah, the English language can be poor and destitute for nouns and adjectives, but I wonder if by labeling it a war, it might attract Trump to do something about it, because all the other reasons, mass destruction, famine, mass migration, cats and dogs sleeping together, mass hysteria, etc., doesn't matter to him. That's too deep intellectually for Trump, and as long as he thinks it won't affect him, he doesn't give a shit. Plus, it's not sexy enough. He needs to feel like he's fighting something and can play the hero because he's so subpar in everything he doesn't, when it comes right down to it. He needs to feel like he's back in the WWF, fake body slamming some schmuck because he's so damn juvenile. Well, that's being too generous. He's so damn toddler. Hey, Darlene, there is no smocking gun. There is no smocking gun. Right. And, well, there's a lot of other stuff to go into this evening. But, we'll take a run at it. Oh, let's see. Okay, Flavio, working within the language. How about a mission against or operation on climate change? A mission makes it thrilling, like Mission Impossible. Can you hear the theme song? An operation implies the patient will either live or die. Just a thought. Megan, meanwhile, says, here's some updated terms for insurance companies paganized for the modern world. If it's a storm, it's an act of Thor. If it's an earthquake, it's an act of Demeter. If it's a tsunami, it's an act of Poseidon. If it's a volcano, it's an act of Pele. If it's a blizzard, it's an act of Elsa. Nice. Nice. Act of Elsa. I saw a photograph today of the elf on the shelf frozen in a pint water glass. Frozen in ice, and an Elsa figurine pointing at it, and, you know, for when you're sick to death of that elf on the shelf. Act of Demeter. You know, earthquakes could also be acts of Poseidon. He was the god of earthquakes, too. James in Illinois says, subject line, another goddamn war. Anytime we declare another war, it allows the usual suspects to once again back a truck up to the Treasury and load her up. Exactly. How many bajillion dollars did we throw down the rat hole with the war on drugs? Which turned out to be the war on pot. Oh, it's too early to go down the legalized cannabis rat hole this evening. Although, God, I have hopes. I have hopes. There's going to be, it has been guaranteed there will be a cannabis legalization bill in the legislature of the state of West Virginia this year. At which point, the good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual, Christian Republicans will clutch their pearls and declare, whatever shall we do, as the deacons wander into the liquor store by the back door. Yeah. All right, let's run over to the... By the way, the stress line's open. You know the number, 304-640-2829, or... toll free if you need us to pay the freight, 844-843-4676. That's 844 the horn. So if you want to get in on the conversation, that's open. How about that? Arnold tells us, according to the thesaurus, there is no word that is a synonym for war that has any public value or virtue. Fascinating, said Spock. Lee informs us, the smocking gun is the newest NRA-certified Second Amendment weapon. When you use a smocking gun, the splatter will produce minimal mess in the room. And it will also result in positively adorable little garments. I remember when Margie was tiny, just a baby. We got her all these gorgeous little smocked dresses, and they were absolutely adorable. They really, really were. But they weren't made with a smocking gun, I'm pretty sure. No. I want to remind you, we need to talk about the Canadian ambassador to the United States. I mean, the United States ambassador to Canada. Sorry. Yeah, we need to talk about that. That's embarrassing as hell. Oh, and thanks very kindly. Rhonda taking us down to 4:55 to go. Thank you, Rhonda. Rhonda saying thank you for all you do. Thank you for keeping this, helping keep this program on the air. It's not my community. It's our community. Thank you, Rhonda. And meanwhile, over on the Skype line, Scott awaits. Hey, Scott.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
Oh, no.
It's
wait.
It's time of the year. Anyway.
Yeah. What
constitutes a Christmas being both holly and jolly? I have seen holly in wreaths on the door, and I've seen jolliness throughout.
I've seen holly on a screen in a movie theater. Her last name was Golightly.
Oh, I remember her.
Ah.
Yes. I remember her. What was her cat? Her cat's name was Cat.
Cat, right.
Which I thought was interesting. I always cry at that scene where the... Oh, don't get me started on...
Well, remember how my buddy Dan was talking about Baby, It's Cold Outside last week?
God, well, don't get me started.
Well, you
on
know,
that.
You know, I'm not. I'm diverting you already.
All right.
you know, there's been a big controversy. Well, you know, it's a nothing burger. It's a non-troversy, really, yeah. About Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh yeah, because of bullying or some such.
And physical differences will not be tolerated unless they are exploitable. Yeah. But I found it funny that somehow or another, Laura Ingraham found her way into opining on the Rudolph issue. This you gotta hear to believe, Scott.
No, and I still won't believe it.
When you think of the left today, are those the kind of people you want to hang around with? Talking like now, beyond politics. They are the biggest killjoys out there. Killjoys. They don't want you to enjoy your life. They want you to listen to them, shut up, and sit down. Lecturing you and haranguing you into what you should feel about...
Oddly enough, that's a word-for-word definition of the last, 28 years of right-wing radio.
About the country, about race, about gender, about all of that. They want to intimidate you. So you're going to turn around in a few years and you're not going to be able, you're going to have to hide your Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer DVD. You have to hide it. You can't keep that around the house. Oh, no.
Really?
That might as well be child pornography. They actually probably like child pornography better than they like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer at this point.
You got that? You got that? I should have issued a hockey puck warning, Scott. But
yeah.
Liberals like child pornography better than Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Why, of course. Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Is she done? I can't take too much of her.
There's 2.5 minutes left, but I don't have it in me.
See, here's the deal with her. If she's so smart, if she's such a beacon of liberty and good information. How is it that she's lost her radio gig? And incidentally, about her radio gig.
No, she didn't lose it. She got promoted. She's in the Bill O'Reilly slot now.
Well, that may well be, but the thing is, she has made a shift from over the air daily terrestrial radio to a podcast of I can't recall whether it's daily or weekly or what. And as far as her TV activities, I don't follow that stuff. But and also, how is it that over the time that she had this supposed great radio program over the air, how is it that there was like a revolving door in the HR department and in her
production staff?
Oh yeah, she couldn't keep a fucking producer. Some people I know who are still active in radio back in D.C., the stories are legion of just the foulness and the mistreatment that she supposedly heaped upon the next newest poor schlub who lumbered in, pardon me, to become her producer of her so-called radio show. It's that, and whenever one of these idiots speak, I go back to fourth grade and use a tried and true retort. I'm rubber, you're glue. Whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you. Because if you really analyze it, all of the supposed charges that from Trump on down that these people use against the supposed lefties, look at the history of it and look at the transcript, boys and girls, and see that each and every one of those things applies to them in their tactics and their mindset. I forget what the psychological terminology is for the projection. Was that it? Racking my brain to psychology.
Yeah, I think projection is one.
Yeah, and Trump is a past master at it. If you can stand to listen to some of his tirades about his real and perceived enemies, each and every charge that he makes is totally applicable to him and not at all, in most cases, applicable to the people that he's pointing his finger at. And as my old Bible-thumping buddy Bob Porter in Roanoke, hello, Bob, if you're out there, used to say, when you point the finger at somebody, there are three fingers pointing back at you. Amen. I almost swallowed my gum.
Well, I was just checking by pointing my finger. And, yep, there are three of them because the thumb usually points along with the index finger.
I've got the coughs. About a half hour ago, I almost swallowed my piece of Nicorette, and I think it bounced against my uvula and came back into my mouth, but it hurt.
God damn it. Went a long way down to get to your uvula, didn't it? Oh, wait, no, that's the hanging down thing. Never mind.
Yes. That's a little dangly thing. And if you can't find that, look for Linda Lovelace and ask her about the uvula.
By the way, Darlene in Connecticut says that you have a sweet singing voice.
I do?
Yes, that's what Darlene says. And in regard to Laura Ingraham, Darlene says, bitch is totally projecting. Yeah, her saying liberals like child porn totally sealed it for me. I'm yet to get over the fact that she got accepted to and graduated from UVA Law School. I'm still puking in my mind over that one.
There you go.
Oh, that's tough when you got to get out the vomit bucket in your brain.
Holly jolly Christmas. What is the deal with Holly and Jolly? I've seen Holly, I've seen Jolly. But the two of them never show up at the same time.
I don't know. Like, maybe Holly, maybe Jolly Holly is a kind of Holly that doesn't have thorns on it, because that shit hurts.
Well, yeah. I hadn't thought about the thorns, but you're absolutely right.
Meanwhile, Arthur just pointed out, yeah, Bob, and after the liberals take our Rudolph the Reindeer movies, they'll take away our child pornography, and then our Rudolph Hess movies, and then... Rudolph Hess movies?
Well,
somebody's been into the holiday brandy a little early.
His nose must have been somewhat lit to parachute into Scotland, or Was he the guy that was held in the prison for all those years? He was. He parachuted into Scotland.
I think so. Right.
Bringing peace.
That's who Chumbawamba's song "The Day the Nazi Died" was about.
Okay. I wasn't aware they had a song about that. The only one song that I'm familiar with by them is that one about the old lady who says, "I've fallen and I can't get up." Didn't they sing that song? I fall down, but I get up again.
Yes, they did. They did. Yeah. I didn't think of it in that context, but you're absolutely right. They did. Darlene says, "I 100% agree with Scott. Trump is the master projector."
Yeah. He's a piece of work. And speaking of Trump, and this is not exactly why I called, but it all ties in one way or another. A week or so ago, 10 days ago, they had a free preview of Showtime, along with a bunch of other premium channels on my cable system. And I recorded the first two episodes. I've got to look it up because I can't remember the name of the damn series. I hate long-titled series. It was a four-part documentary series on Showtime, Enemies, the President, Justice, and the FBI. Okay? And the main things that they covered were Watergate, Iran-Contra, Clinton-Lewinsky, and the last episode that aired Sunday night was You're Fired, having to do with Trump's difficulties with the FBI and justice and the presidency. And like I say, on the preview, I was able to catch the first two episodes, but I had to subscribe to Showtime on my cable carrier, to get the last two episodes, and I'll probably cancel later this week. But they aired the one about Trump last night, and all in all, it's a good enough series to where if you have Showtime or can get Showtime, record all four episodes because it'll give you a good concise history of difficulties that presidents have when they try to overstep their bounds, or when they are, in the case of Clinton, when they are perceived to have overstepped their bounds. But the one about Trump was pretty good. I mean, it ties everything together in a way that if you just landed here from Mars and wanted to know American presidential justice history over the last 40 some years, it would bring you pretty much up to speed. But that's not why I called.
No, but I do have to tell you that our buddy Texas T has just remarked, Scott is a dead ringer for Burl Ives. You were pretty close on that. I'm guessing you could go to a bar with a holiday karaoke somewhere in the greater San Diego area and maybe score a couple of vodka martinis.
I don't know that there's much call for that talent in today's world, Bob, but I'll try it.
Oh, no. I don't know. Maybe you'd have to go to a more conservative part of California.
Tell you how I came to have that dubious talent. Back in the mid-90s, when I moved from Tulsa, got divorced, moved from Tulsa to the Cincinnati area, I got involved with a much younger woman. And she, for her age group, and let's say she was in her early 20s, and I at the time was like 41, thereabouts. So there was it was destined not to work out because I was sidling up to old farthood, even at the age of 41, okay? So a woman that young is just not gonna, work out. Plus, I had other issues besides. But she was, strangely enough for her age, she was a big fan of the Music of Your Life radio stations, the big bands.
Oh, yes.
And the middle-of-the-road music and pop standards and all that. And she liked Holly Jolly Christmas, but she didn't like Burl Ives' tune, Little Bitty Tear. Drag me down, mm-hmm, spoiled mm-hmm. my
act
my
as a clown.
Act as a Clown. Yeah, okay. And she hated that song. Whenever it would come on, she'd turn off the radio.
When I was little, I had a 33 of Burl Ives doing classic folk songs.
I'll bet it was good, too.
Oh, it was fantastic. Let's see. Robin E. married a wife from the West, Muppety Muppety Mono. She turned out to be none of the best with a high chick, chickity pup, and cutter, Robin, Christ, Mono, no. That was one of them.
Yeah.
There was a song about some English sea battle where the pirates cried no quarter. And I mean, it just, you know, for a little 5-year-old guy, it just made a little hair stand up on the back of my neck that I didn't even have yet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was fantastic. And of course, for those who've never seen the Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward version of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, where he plays, Burl Ives plays Big Daddy.
It's Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor, I think.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is. But he is fantastic. Just a magnificent performance as Big Daddy.
You know, he was also good in the sequel to Mr. Roberts, you know, the Henry Fonda, William Powell, Jack Lemmon movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big stage play. Well, the follow-up some years later was a movie called Ensign Pulver. And instead of Jimmy Cagney as the head of the naval vessel, Burl Ives was the captain of the ship. And I'm trying to think of the young fellow who was the Ensign Pulver. It might have been Jim Hutton. No? There's two actors that look vaguely alike. One of them is Jim Hutton, and the other one isn't. And I would Google it, but the memory experts say that you shouldn't automatically Google stuff, because if the information is in your head,
you need to be able to
slosh it around a bit.
Yeah.
And it'll come to the surface. But anyway, Burl Ives was the captain of the ship, and it was a comedic movie, a comedy, but there was drama in it. Oh, and there was I believe that is the movie that had a, or was that the original? I don't know. I was going to say in one of those films, either Ensign Pulver or Mr. Roberts, there was a rather young Betsy Palmer who was on.
That would be Mr. Roberts. She was one of the women, one of the nurses on the island for whom they made up a fake bottle of scotch.
I had such a crush on her back in the days when she was on the panel of I've Got a Secret. I don't know what. You can have your Bess Meyerson. Give me old Betsy Palmer. Oh, baby.
I always loved that scene in Mr. Roberts where Doc and Mr. Roberts are trying to figure out, because they've got a Johnny Walker bottle.
Yeah, empty.
And they've already promised a bottle of scotch.
Yeah, to the nurses on the island.
Okay, so we'll take some alcohol from the torpedo room. That was the first stock. And then we'll add a little bit of Coca-Cola for color. And then there's an exchange between Henry Fonda and the guy who played the doc.
Yeah, William Powell.
William Powell, yep.
A great actor.
And of course they're in his infirmary. What does scotch taste like to you? Well, Doc, I always thought it tasted a little bit like iodine. Me too. And he puts a couple of drops of iodine in it. And then they pour a taste. And say, ah, that's good scotch.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I've gone off track again, Bob. Why do I do this? I need one of those things that children in department stores, you'll see them, a parent will have their hand on a piece of nylon cord, and at the other end of the nylon cord is a harness holding the little toddler.
Oh, a toddler leash, yes.
Yeah, I need that conversationally, because
just kind of reel you back in now and then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I go so off track sometimes, I forget.
Well, we've got a warning here from Lee in New York.
Okay.
Subject line, Burl Ives. Don't get Laura Ingraham started. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. She links that to child pornography. Burl Ives hosted the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer animated cartoon. Scott looks like Burl Ives. Laura Ingraham will not connect Scott to anything good. God, I love this program.
I think it's more about the sound. I don't think I look like Burl Ives at all. I think it's the that little signature. Have a holly jolly Christmas.
Yeah, you've got it down right.
But anyway, the thing about was itty bitty little bitty tear. Whenever that song would come on, my young girlfriend would freak out and turn off the radio. And when I wanted to get her goat, so to speak, I would sing the first bar or so of little itty bitty tear or whatever the hell it was. But again, that's not why I called.
That's not either, right.
Why I called, among other things, was over the weekend I needed to free up some space on the DVR. And back almost a year ago, like January of this year, 2018, there was a six-part series, a movie, a dramatic film series on something called the Paramount Network, of all things, which I didn't even know I had. But the title was one-word title, simply Waco. And I recorded it, all 6 hours of it, but never watched it. And I said, well, here's what I'll do this weekend. I'll watch that and free up 6 hours of DVR space. And it was okay because I kind of tuned all of that out during Waco and the Mount Carmel siege of 51 days. And the FBI and the ATF and David Koresh and the Seven Seals and all that happy crappy. But I watched it, and it dawned on me how much that incident had to do with other outrages, the connection it had supposedly to other outrages. I give you the Oklahoma City bombing of the Murrow Building. I give you the armed militias on the extreme right. I give you the white nationalist groups up in places like Idaho and Montana that these guys, Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh, apparently hooked up with.
Right.
I give you George H.W. Bush, who gave us Operation... What the name was that operation of the Kuwait incursion by Saddam? What did they even call that? Operation Enduring?
Was that it? Enduring Freedom?
So many goddamn operations, it's hard to keep them straight in your mind.
Yeah, even the Pentagon won't call things war anymore, and we got people running, we need a war on climate change.
Yeah, well, they're operations. They haven't been wars for years, but... Timothy McVeigh apparently was in the military and had a bad experience during the Gulf War, which supposedly embittered him. But now, and that was like in the mid-90s, okay? That was a while back. But all
By the way, Arnold tells us that was Operation Desert Storm.
Desert Storm, yes. Well, all of that madness that was stirred up in the wake of the Gulf War, the Murrow bombing, the militia movement in this country, the white nationalist movement in this country, and then you take it around that time frame, you had the House, after 40-some years, being taken over by the GOP and Gingrich and his forces of evil and madness, and all of that stew... All of the ingredients in that stew have bubbled and mingled and simmered. And then when it was Trump's time to come along, he had his built-in fan base, let's say. And watching that film, and it wasn't a half bad film, okay, about Waco, but watching that, those events dramatically portrayed of so long ago, and then superimposing over that the events and the madness of today, it fits right in. You know? So I don't know if that film is available anywhere, but it was one of those things that for whatever reason, I pretty much tuned it out you know, because it went on for like 51 days, and it was like, you know, one new chunk of madness day after day. And it was just one of those things that I could not focus on because it hurt. It hurt my mind. It hurt my heart, you know, to see that going on. And I have friends, actually had friends.
You have friends.
Who thought that it was a legitimate exercise of religious freedom, and the jackbooted thugs of the ATF and the FBI were infringing upon the Branch Davidians' religious freedom. And I suppose there's some argument along those lines that could be given, but it's like act of God in insurance policies. It's like such horseshit, and people buy into it, and it's part of our established order of things in this country. But if people were honest, they would say, well, we know it's all horseshit, but it keeps people halfway settled down. So let's not disturb their illusions.
Yeah, it keeps the rubes from looking behind the curtain. Sure.
Yeah.
Randy says, by the way, don't forget Fox News, and of course not. And David in South Carolina, Stan, reminds us that before Bush's war, W's war. Bush War II. I call them Bush War I and Bush War II.
Yeah.
Before Bush War II, of course, OIL, Operation Iraqi Liberation. And as quick as those geniuses figured out it spelled oil, like, oh, fuck, you're going to say they were right. It's a war for oil.
Yeah.
Hey, so here's a little interlude for the programs. You started on Burl Ives, by God. I actually found, while we were talking, I found that album with all those folk songs on it, and I found the one with the pirates.
Okay.
And it's called High Barbaree, and this will probably keep the program from posting on YouTube, which is hilarious because I found it on YouTube.
Yeah, and there's the irony.
Yeah, here we go. Ominous, huh?
There were two lofty ships from old England came, blow high, blow low, and so sailed we. One was the Prince of Lothar and the other Prince of Wales, cruising down the coast of High Barbaree.
Well, you can almost hear the yo-hos in there, can't you?
Aloft there, aloft, our jolly boatswain cried, blow high, blow low, and so sailed we. Look ahead, look astern, look aweather, look alee, looking down the coast of High Barbaree.
Grim stuff.
There's naught upon the stern, there is naught upon the lee, blow high, blow low, and so sail we. But there's a lofty ship to windward, a sailing fast and free, sailing down the coast of High Barbaree. Oh, hail her, oh, hail her, our gallant captain cried, blow high, blow low, and so sailed we. Are you a man of war or a privateer, said he, cruising down the coast of High Barbaree? I'm not a man of war nor a privateer, said he, blow high, blow low, and so sailed we. But I am a salt sea pirate, a-looking for my fee, looking down the coast of High Barbaree. T'was broadside and broadside a long time we lay, blow high, blow low, and so sailed we, until the Prince of Lothar shot the pirate's mast away, cruising down the coast of High Barbary. Oh, quarter, those pirates did cry, blow high, blow low, so sailed we. But the quarter that we gave them, we sunk them in the sea, down along the coast of High Barbary.
How about
I like that.
That's a far cry from any holly jolly Christmas now, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems to me, and it's been a while since I've read his entry on Wikipedia, but it seems to me in his younger days, he was a hobo. He rode the rails.
Well, he would have been of that generation, but damn, he could pick, couldn't he?
Oh, sure, sure. But he was somewhat of an authority also on folk music and those types of ballads.
Well, this one particular album, The Wayfaring Stranger, is chock-a-block. On top of Old Smokey's there, Sweet Betsy from Pike. And some of them are fun. The Leather-Winged Bat. I used to dearly adore, let me see if I can find it real quick, just because we're being kind of esoteric for a second. Coffee time, is it?
Yeah, that song timed out perfectly for the nuking of the water for the cheapo instant Java.
This was always one that I found kind of humorous, and he taps into that. Obviously, that was an English that probably started out in England, High Barbary. But there's some Robin E. Mary has a very Irish flavor to it, and then there's this: The Devil's Wife and the Farmer.
Okay.
A farmer was ploughing his field one day, rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. A farmer was ploughing his field one day, when the devil came up unto him, he did say, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day, rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. See here, me good man, I have come for your wife. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. See here, me good man, I have come for your wife. She's the bane and torment of your life, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day, rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. So the divil he heisted her up on his hump.
Divil.
Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. The divil he heisted her up on his hump. Down to hell with her he did jump, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. When they got there, the gates were shut. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. When they got there, the gates were shut. With a sweep of her arm, she lay open his nut, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. Two little divils were playing handball. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. Two little divils were playing handball. They said, take her out, daddy, she'll kill us all. With a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. So the divil he heisted her up on his hump. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. The divil he heisted her up on his hump. Back to earth with her he did jump. With a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. See here, me good man, I have come with your wife. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. See here, me good man, I have come with your wife. She's the bane and torment of me life, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. So they say that the women are worse than the men. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day. They say that the women are worse than the men. They went down to hell and got chucked out again, with a rightful law, titty-fi-day. Rightful, rightful, titty-fi-day.
And see, there's a subversive quality to that, because it's obviously either Scots or, I'm guessing, Irish. And it's a gentle warning: don't fuck with an Irish woman.
Yeah.
Because she kicked she'll kick the ass of the devil himself.
What is the vintage of that album? I'm guessing
mid to late 50s.
Yeah, because there were younger folks and probably some of us older folks don't remember. There was a period in this country and maybe in other parts of the world where folk music was a thing. from like the late 50s.
Oh, and this is smack dab in the middle of the folk revival of the mid-50s to early 60s,
yeah.
The, you know, the coffee houses and whatnot. And that album sold like hotcakes.
Oh, I'm sure it did, because, and there was a show on Saturday night, I guess, on ABC TV for a year or two called Hootenanny. And they would go to college campuses all over the country, or other venues, and feature for an hour some of the top folk artists in the country. This was around like 61, 62 or thereabouts. Think of that. On primetime TV, 1 hour a week, folk music. You sure don't get that on Laura Ingraham's program.
No, you don't. No, you so don't.
And usually a thing has to get big enough for someone like Tom Lehrer, who is also of that era in a different vein, to satirize it. And he's got a tune on one of his albums, The Folk Song Army. We are the folk song army. Guitars are the weapons we bring in the fight against poverty, war, and it goes on. It goes on and on.
I wonder if that might have been partially inspired by the guitar that who was it?
Woody Guthrie.
Woody Guthrie. This machine kills fascists.
Yeah. Well, I wondered, you know, getting back to Burl Ives, riding the rails at probably in the 1930s. One wonders if he crossed paths with Woody Guthrie. And if he did, maybe that moved him in the direction of being interested in performing and knowing about folk music, because everything's connected in a lovely way, at least the good stuff. I'll let you look it up. I'm too lazy today. I will tell you from the There's One Less of Them and One Than There Are of Us department about a week ago. Here's a name from the past, Lester Kinsolving. Do you remember that name?
I want to.
Defrocked Episcopal priest and pesky White House questioner dies at 90. And in his late years, the last 20-some years, he held forth on a Baltimore conservative talk radio station. And his obituary is in the Post. And old Lester shuffled off this mortal coil, bringing the score to One Less of Them. A detestable fellow. If I hate to speak ill of the dead, but I do like to speak truth of the living and the dead. So there. Lester Roast. Roast.
Well, Burl Ives was born in 1909. I went ahead and looked it up.
Okay.
Burl Ickle Ivanhoe Ives.
What a name. That's a great name.
Yeah, I mean, how are you going to not?
And I'll wager here and now any amount that you name that there's not another program in the known universe talking about the heyday of folk music and or Burl Ives. I'm willing to bet good greenback dollars to quote another title of a great song. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead.
Well, he lived to be 85. He was a radio star in the 40s, so I don't think he rode the rails. Or maybe if he did, it was before then. The Wayfaring Stranger was the name of his radio show. And after serving with Irving Berlin, according to Wikipedia, when This Is the Army, he was a major star of CBS radio. So he was an itinerant singer during the 1930s.
Yeah.
I thought
that was something.
Jailed in Mona, Utah for vagrancy and for singing The Foggy Dew.
Oh.
And authorities said that was a bawdy song. If that's the same Foggy Dew I'm thinking of, there ain't nothing bawdy about it.
Where was this, in Idaho? Or
no,
Utah.
Utah.
Well, now, those magic underwear-wearing types, bawdiness is a relative term when you're dealing with them. I mean...
For God's sakes, he went to Juilliard.
Well...
But, no, only, no. But let it be noted that this is probably the only radio program in the entire United States today or this month or this year that has featured an in-depth discussion of Burl Ives.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Read his name again, his full name. That's Burl, so lyrical.
Burl Ickle, I-C-L-E, Ivanhoe Ives.
Hmm.
You know, if you got Ivanhoe in your name, something's going to happen in your life. There's no getting around it.
Yeah. Jeez, what?
And, you know, by the way, I'll mention we've got $455 in fundraising to go because Steve from Georgistan just asked me by email a minute ago, what's next, heavy metal Pat Boone?
Oh, no. I was hoping no one would remember that.
No, it's all there.
Mm.
Didn't
Donny Osmond do a metal or a rock, heavy rock sort of?
Oh God, probably so. And it'll make
music.
Please don't do that to my little brain cells.
Jeez. Well, I've wound an interesting path. Hopefully, it will serve as a springboard for the next several callers. Because I love it, these dangling, rambling conversations where any number of things can come up and be talked about and learned about. See, that's the distinction that sets this type of program apart from what you find in typical right-wing radio. The element of learning, of expanding our body of actual knowledge based on sources and reality and stuff, you know? And who knows, it could open a second career for me. All I need to do is learn the guitar, put on about 100 more pounds, grow a goatee, and I can be, you know, I can do a one-man tribute to Burl Ives on stages across the known universe.
Well, you might, and just the way things all work out, I had no idea you were going to call in and work the Holly Jolly angle at the beginning of the call. We didn't set this up. And yet earlier in the day, I hear Ferg singing, because Ferg sings.
Yeah, quite well, actually.
But he sings the lyrics not quite right. He sings, have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year. There'll be snow and mistletoe, but they weren't entirely clear. I stopped in my tracks and went, what? That's perfect.
And a lot of foamy beer would fit in a stanza of that song.
Well, you know, sooner or later, you knew this had to turn into a milkshake, Duck.
Or mead. Mead would be the proper beverage for folk songs, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, it could be, especially in oldie English, and in a mead hall called Hrothgar or something like that. No, Hrothgar was the king. I can't remember my Beowulf, but no, this is now it's turned into a milkshake duck though, because note just came in from Flavio. You know what a milkshake duck is, right?
Well, I'm afraid to know. There are some things that even I am afraid to know.
There was this guy, I guess he was a cartoonist or whatever, but he was watching Social Developments a couple of years back, and he invented the concept of milkshake duck. And a milkshake duck is, something will go, say it's a picture of a duck drinking a milkshake.
Yeah, okay.
And it goes internet viral, and the whole world sees the milkshake drinking duck, and two, and after it's gone all over the world, it turns out that, well, the duck's a racist, or that the duck is so it's a concept for describing anything that becomes famous very rapidly, and then you find out something terrible about the thing that you thought was famous and adorable.
Oh no!
So that's a milkshake duck.
So and someone is
so Flavio has now turned Burlives into a milkshake duck.
Oh, dear.
Subject line, didn't Burlives rat on his friends to Huach? In 1952, he cooperated with the House Un-American Activities Committee and agreed to testify, fearful of losing his source of income. Ives' statement to the Huach ended his blacklisting, allowing him to continue acting in movies, but it also led to a bitter rift between Ives and many folk singers, including Pete Seeger. That's the one who had This Machine. Pete Seeger was one of This Machine Kills Fascists. Who accused Ives of...
I thought Woody Guthrie did.
Well, somebody will have to sort that out for us. Pete Seeger, who accused Ives of naming names and betraying the cause of cultural and political freedom to save his own career. 41 years later, Ives, by then confined to a wheelchair, reunited with Seeger during a benefit concert in New York City. Having reconciled years earlier, they sang Blue Tail Fly together.
You know, I think they showed that in the documentary about Pete Seeger, or it might have been the documentary about the Weavers from some years ago. There's another great folk group and politically astute. Who was that? Pete Seeger, a woman named Ronnie. I can't remember her last name. Fred, was it Hillerman? And a rather portly gentleman who kind of resembled Burl Ives, who was also a composer, and all of them suspect and or blacklisted. That is from the late 40s all through the 50s until McCarthy went crazy. Oh, God. And if you had awakened me in the dead of night or day and said, later today you're going to have an in-depth discussion about folk music and Burl Ives and Woody Guthrie and messages on guitars and banjos and to see the Weavers, I would have said, you're crazy.
Okay, Woody Guthrie. Flavio has confirmed it was Woody Guthrie, yep.
Okay, I thought it was. But I believe Pete Seeger did have a message inscribed on his banjo, but I'm hard-pressed to tell you what it was. This side up? No.
Yeah, Steve from Georgistan and Flavio jumped out there as the ad hoc research department for the horn and verified that it was Woody.
In terms of anything that Burl Ives might or might not have said to the House Un-American Activities Committee, there was a lot of that going around back then, and each person had to choose for him or herself what the right way to go was. Who was that esteemed director who late in life was awarded a special Academy Award?
Elia Kazan?
And half of Hollywood, for many of the same reasons, were not happy about that move because they thought that Kazan had sold out.
Well, have you ever, did you see that movie a few years back called Trumbo?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I watched it again not long ago. Great movie. And, well, hell, Bryan Cranston can do no wrong in my book as an actor. And you've heard what his latest project is, haven't you?
What?
On Broadway, I'm as mad as hell.
Network. Yeah.
And I hope they make that into a movie of some sort because, like I say, Bryan Cranston is aces with me, baby. I love that man's work and his story just as a human being. An actor who paid the dues and showed up for every little assignment that he could get for 20-some years and was ready when the offer was made to star in Breaking Bad and was richly the viewers were richly rewarded given the quality of his work and those around him and the writers and the production staff of that show, and it was his ultimate springboard. I mean, to anything that he does after Breaking Bad is aces with me. I mean, who has he done so far? LBJ in that movie and Broadway play, and also Trumbo, and now Howard Beale. That's the fucking trilogy. That's getting three darts dead center in my book. But I go on.
Oh, no worries. I mean, no argument.
But anyway, about
me.
Burl Ives, that if you look back to the history of the 50s and the blacklisting, people were damn scared. I mean, there were deaths that came out of it. People who had been working steadily and were blacklisted, who were falsely charged, it later turned out, who lost their livelihoods and were reduced to the only way out for them was to end it. I mean, what kind of madness produces that effect? You know?
Frenzy's a political bigotry.
Well, yeah. And I don't know that blacklisting occurs in the same way today, but there is marginalization of notions and ideas and conversation. And even some of us on this end of the political spectrum get into that. I give you, not to beat this horse and make it further dead, but this nonsense about, baby, it's cold outside. It's a fucking song that dates back to the 1940s. And it's like that old joke, Bob, about the guy who goes to the psychiatrist. And maybe this is a good way to close. A guy that goes to the psychiatrist, and the shrink shows him the ink blots, the Rorschach test. And with each new card that the shrink flips, the guy describes an even more filthy scenario. And at the end of the test, the shrink kind of hems and haws, and he says, well, you know, you have an awfully twisted, perverted mind. And the patient says, well, hell, you're the one showing me the dirty pictures. And I say that to some of these songs. People read into them what they want. And if they're going to ban Baby It's Cold Outside, well, let's ban Santa Baby, because it promotes gold digging by young opportunistic women. Or let's ban I'll Be Home for Christmas, because it's unfair to street people. I mean, the nonsense could go on ad in nauseam. And it just riles me up, you know?
Well, among other things, there's one thing to be, as Dan pointed out last week, it's not even particularly Christmassy. It's just a song about cold weather.
Sorry, I had to cough. Well, yeah, it is, but there's another song from the movie Mame. We Need a Little Christmas is not exactly a Christmas song, because in the plot of Mame, they're upon tough times, and they decide to remedy that by celebrating Christmas early, hence the title We Need a Little Christmas. And that has become, a Christmas song. And what was that one, that Judy Garland film where the family's in St. Louis and the father is transferred back to New York?
Is that Meet Me in St. Louis?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
With Easter Bonnet?
I don't know if Easter Bonnet is in that, but there's one song that's in it, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which...
Yeah.
The circumstances.
Yeah, that's a real tearjerker too.
Oh yeah, yeah. But it's.
I'll be home for Christmas. Whoa.
Yeah. Or I'll have a blue Christmas. Boy, the copyright police are gonna have a field day with me today. But I don't know. I just. There are other things.
I always preferred poor. Wait a minute. Okay, it's we can do this kind of thing. I always preferred the, hold on a minute. Just give me a second.
Okay.
You brought that song up.
Yeah.
We've already screwed up the file for, anyway, so.
Another great anti-Christmas song is Tom Lehrer's immortal A Christmas Carol.
Well, there it was. I typed in the first few letters, and it was the first one that showed up.
What?
This. Let me make sure there's no ad. No, there's no ad.
All right.
You hear the winter winds?
We'll start the show. I drew this cartoon all by myself, but shucks, it wasn't hard because I'm an artist. I hope you like it.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll feel so blue. You're just thinking. Be about you. It'll be decorations of red on a green Christmas tree. It won't be the same, dear, if you're not here with me. And when those blue snowflakes start falling, that's when those blue memories start calling. You'll be doing all right with your Christmas of white. But I'll have a blue Christmas.
Yeah, that.
I had no idea where you were going, but I'm glad you went there.
Well, hey, but by the way, just to bring a little, hopefully, just a tiny little bit of relevance back to the conversation. People getting bent about content has been around for a while. And I'm old enough to remember some of the early salvos. I've mentioned, you know, we play clips from time to time of helmet-headed proud son of Stanford, Brian Fisher, of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, Stan. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, the guy who started that was Donald, a preacher huckster by the name of Donald Wildman,
mm-hmm.
who was convinced that everybody who wasn't following him was headed for hell. And he launched a fatwa in the late 70s, early 80s, against Warner Brothers cartoons. And cartoons in general, because they were promoting violence and immoral behavior in our in our culture. Never mind the fact that these things were already 40 and 50 years old, but
yeah.
You know,
and they were all naked.
Anvils getting dropped on coyotes, coyotes riding missiles into the canyon walls, Bugs Bunny putting his fingers in shotguns and making the shotgun blow up in Elmer's face. Dropping things on the right, and all of these things got Donald Wildman all kinds of head up, and then of course he passed the plate, and we played his little cassette recordings every week there, and sometimes it would fall to me to do it there. We Barely Talk Good, and it was the only way you could get through it would be to kind of open up the back window, spark up a number, and just kind of goof on it a little bit. But then, you know, a few years later, and it's Jerry Falwell having conniptions because Tinky Winky carries a purse, and suddenly the Teletubbies are going to turn all our precious cheerins all gay-like.
Yeah.
And so every generation unto its own. Now it's baby, it's cold outside, kind of, when you get right down to it, disturbing themes that are included in, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, where he's a freak until he's needed. And nobody wants a Charlie in the box. And nobody has explained to this day what's wrong with that little Dolly who's on the Island of Misfit Toys. She looks perfectly okay. But somehow or another, she wound up on the Island of Misfit Toys with the Charlie in the box. So,
well, and the two things that, these supposed outrages have in common, from as I look at it, one of them is diversion, and the other thing that they have in common is they're aimed at people who will react angrily, outrageously, before really thinking through what the deal is. Is that
in a former time, something like the outrage of "Baby, it's cold outside," we'd have a good time, lightheartedly arguing about it at the holiday party. But we live in America now where people shoot each other at Thanksgiving over whether to watch the parade or not.
Yeah, yeah. The stakes have become much, much higher because we're more widely armed and more deeply angry and jealous of our rightness. You know, I think it all comes down to people who mischose when they were asked the question, would you rather be right or happy? And by the way, because I know I'll get feedback, okay, for my comments about my take on the outrage about the song, okay? I do, you know, this is not to excuse the valid points that people make about the issue that they're actually upset about.
Well,
I think with
Baby, It's Cold Outside, it really crosses the line when the implication has been made that that he's spiked her drink.
Is that really what the song alludes to? I mean, the guy who wrote it, whose name I forget.
Yeah, it was a husband and wife team, and they did it as a lark, and they'd perform it at holiday parties in the 40s.
And the thing is, I mean, was that on their mind? Was that their original intent in the song? Because I maintain that long before this current outrage, a somewhat common phrase in society, upon taking a sip of something that was made perhaps with too much gusto, is, good Lord, what's in this? What's in this drink? You know, what are you trying to do to me? And maybe I'm not sensitive enough or too sensitive or something, but here I'm going on about it, and I need to shut up about it because there are way more important things to focus attention upon than a song that in 3 weeks' time we're not going to hear until next year, maybe. You know, it's that same stupid shit as with the Dixie Chicks during the invasion of Iraq, you know, not that long ago, where the fucking Clear Channel radio stations decided to be all patriotic and stuff and ban certain songs that would upset or outrage or confuse the listeners. Well, if those folks are that easily upset, confused, or outraged that a fucking three-minute song is going to set them off and put them over the edge, you know, a radio is too dangerous for them to have because it might drop into the fucking bathtub with them.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that there is an updated version. So,
Baby, It's Cold Outside?
Absolutely.
Oh, dear.
Here we go.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Got to get it all. Got to unmute.
Oh, yes.
I really can't stay.
Okay, you're free to go.
I've got to go away.
Understood, no means no.
This evening has been
super appropriate.
So very nice.
But I do understand consent.
My mom will start to worry.
Definitely text her right
and
now.
And father will be pacing the floor.
Here's the code and there is the
so
door.
So really I'd better scurry.
I am gonna stand over
well,
here.
Maybe just a half a drink
you
more.
You are in control of this
the
thing.
The neighbors might think.
Invite them over if you like.
Say, what's in this drink?
Nothing but Sprite.
I wish I knew how.
Just walk right out the door.
To break the spell.
I do know how to spell harassment.
I
hear you loud and clear.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
I'm trying super
I really
hard.
Can't stay.
Please just go out, baby.
Oh,
just go outside.
I simply must go.
Uber is right outside.
The answer is no.
Seriously, right outside.
The welcome has been.
I'll walk you to
so
the curb.
Nice and warm.
But totally consensual.
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Hopefully not about
at least
us.
There will be plenty implied.
Please do not imply anything.
I really can't stay.
Baby, just go out. Baby,
baby
just
it's cold.
Go. Baby, just go outside.
I love it. I love it. It's perfectly fine.
Baby, just go outside.
Baby, just go outside and take the dog with you because he or she probably has to pee too. But I hadn't intended to talk this long. Let me close with this.
Okay.
I'll be really concerned with the lyrics of Baby, It's Cold Outside as originally written as soon as A, Bill Cosby starts singing it, and B, Michael Bublé stops singing it. I mean, that'll be my metric for when to get outraged. This too shall pass.
It all will. It all will.
Yeah, there'll be some new outrage, and we'll get upset about that, or I will, because that's how I'm wired. It's been another great chat, Bob.
They all are, Scott. They all are.
And I'm going to look around for more work by Burl Ives, because he was a fine human being.
Well, you'll enjoy that whole album. It's right there. Just look up Burl Ives, Wayfaring Stranger on YouTube. It's right there.
All right, I will.
And you'll enjoy it start to finish.
I may play it backwards for satanic messages, just for extra points.
I think you probably should.
All right. Take care, man.
All right, Scott. Enjoy the freeze-dried wonderfulness.
Oh, I do. See ya.
Later. Our buddy Scott calling from San Diego, 22 minutes past the hour. Hey, we took it down a little further. Thank you very kindly, Jude, up in the great Northwest. We are now down to 435. 435, which that's almost, that's $80 this evening. That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Jude. Thank you very kindly. Jude said, the baby just go outside. Now, that singer sounded as if it was you. Trust me, that was not me. I cannot carry a tune that well. And by the way, Lee says, as far as Rudolph is concerned, do we put too much attention on a song created as an ad campaign for Montgomery Ward? And it was exactly that, and it took off like wildfire. And then the animated classic first aired in 1964, and it's held up fairly well, I guess. But you know, the idea that you can be different, but only if you can serve the greater cause, or in this case, the greater clause. Ooh, I'm going to go to hell for that one. Yes. I guess we can get back to more In Monday stuff. Hey, how about a nomination for good old Orrin Hatch? As soon as this Congress dies its merciful death, Orrin Hatch, who has done as much or more wickedness and evil as any member of the United States Senate, will no longer be a member of the United States Senate. In fact, his replacement will be a young whippersnapper and failed presidential candidate by the name of Bishop Willard Romney. He was inquiry was made of Senator Hatch about the fact that the President of the United States has now been implicated in no less than 4 federal felonies. That he is, in fact, an unindicted co-conspirator. Responding to this, Orrin Hatch said, the Democrats will do anything to hurt this president. And when somebody looked at Orrin Hatch and said, you know, no Democrats brought this. This was a charge brought against Michael Cohen by the Southern District of New York. Prosecutors, federal prosecutors from Bush, from Trump's own Justice Department. Well, then he said, well, okay, but I don't care. All I can say is he's doing a good job as president. You might recall that Orrin Hatch once said he didn't care if Brett Kavanaugh had done everything he was charged with. Asking, I think it would be hard for senators to not consider who the judge is today. That's the issue. Is this judge really a good man? And he is. And by any measure, he is. So this kind of goes back to something that I've been talking about for a little bit and probably needs to be reinforced a little. And that is my conviction that if the House impeaches Donald Trump, which it's looking more and more like they may really have no choice but to do, I'm willing to. I'm out there on record again tonight, the 10th of December, 2018, 8:26 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, saying that chinless Mitch McConnell simply will not allow the bill to be tried in the Senate. He'll just say we're not going to try it, not going to do it. Sorry. And people say, well, but he has to. No, he doesn't. There's nobody to stop him. Supreme Court can't compel him to do it. Trump won't. The voters of Kentucky won't remove him from office in 2020 for doing it. I think we need to come to grips with the fact that, well, Chinless Mitch is a law unto himself. And he won't. He'll know because the Republicans in the Senate won't want to try it in the first place. And while the Republicans are defending 20 seats in 2020, they're mostly in places that are deemed safe seats. So just maybe keep that in mind. Think about people like, well, Orrin Hatch, who will not vote to convict under any set of circumstances. Of course, he won't be there. He'll be replaced by Bishop Willard Romney, who would not vote to convict Donald Trump either. All you have to do is go through the roster of the Senate, and every time you see a Republican say, won't vote to convict. Susan Collins, noted moderate, of Maine, is up for re-election in 2020, and she won't vote to convict. Now, I realize I'm presupposing the impeachment, but really, what do you do when you are the House of Representatives and you have a constitutional obligation, and you take a powder on that obligation? I mean, It's a hell of a spot to be in. The smart money says, no, don't impeach. Just get him the hell out of office in 2020. Because, again, an impeachment that does not include removal from office via a conviction in the Senate, it ain't worth, and this is a complicated legal term here, it ain't worth diddly. Plain and simple. So, sort of sort of bear that in mind. Bill in Allentown says, isn't Hatch's young whippersnapper replacement in his late 60s or early 70s? Why, yes. Yes, he is. But let's do remember that the root word, the Latin root word from which we take the word senate, means old. A senate is a place for the elders to gather. The Romans called it a senate in Greece. In Greek, they called it a gerousia. Geriatric comes from the same Greek root word. Senatorial type bodies are generally, well, considered to be a place for the culture, the nation, the people's elders to deliberate what's right and what's wrong. Of course, the right versus wrong part went out the window a long time ago. But it is a place predicated on the so-called wisdom of the elders. And this is where I got, what's that, Brother Deacon Asa says, is Turtle Man guaranteed to be the only majority leader in the new Senate? Yeah, I'd say so. Are you kidding? Every Republican in the Senate lives in mortal fear of Mitch McConnell for reasons that are not abundantly clear, and many of them hate his guts, but they won't cross him because apparently bad things happen. We had conversations with Republicans who told us outright in years past that this senator or that senator, a Republican, would like to sign on to an introduction of the AIC Act along, in a bipartisan way with a Democrat, but that Mitch McConnell would not let them, and that if they did something against Mitch McConnell's word, they would be severely punished. Now, as for all that impeachment stuff that I was talking about a moment ago, I had a note from Greg. Hartman was fantasizing today on his program about a dual impeachment for Trump and Pence come January 19. Giving Pelosi the Oval Office, who will then make poor old Granny Pantsuits her vice president, and then resign so Hillsbilly can finally have her coronation. Please don't tell me that you might agree with that scenario. Okay, I won't tell you that. But the fact of the matter is, the latest business with the chief of staff, and everybody said that Ayers guy was going to wind up being chief of staff because he was Pence's chief of staff, and then the Ayers guy said, no, I'll pass, thanks. No, I've got to do my hair those 2 years. I hear my mother calling. The dog ate my appointment papers. It's something, nothing. I ain't going to prison. But wouldn't that have been a little bit interesting? Wouldn't that have almost smelled like it was paving the way for Pence to be president? Because this is where the complications arise. Pence may be implicated. And we'll get a better idea for the shape of things to come when we find out if Pence is implicated, because the best thing if you use history as a guide, you go after Pence first, and that makes Trump have to go and find a new vice president, and then he has to work out the pardon deal with the new vice president. Because already there are conversations taking place about whether to keep Pence on the ticket in 2020. Because there's been some polling work done, and it turns out Mike Pence doesn't detract from the ticket as such. but he also brings nothing to it. But every now and then I try to send a little tweet toward Donald Trump to get him thinking about things. And one of the things I mentioned over the weekend is that Mike Pence reminds me of that line from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Cassius has a lean and hungry look. If Ayers had taken the chief of staff job in the White House, it would have been as if the carpet were already being rolled out for Mike Pence to go and be president, right? But remember, Mike Pence is an evangelical fundamentalist, homosexual Christian, and he probably thinks that he's vice president because God wants him to be president. Because remember, Mike Pence admits to hearing voices. And then gets in a snit when people suggest that people who hear voices should probably take medication to make the voices stop. Right. But Mike Pence is a man of destiny, but we know that for weeks now, Julius Geezer has been rumbling, stumbling, and bumbling around the White House asking, do you think I can really trust Mike Pence? I mean, is he really somebody that'll be loyal to me? Well, Donnie, if you mean take a prison sentence for you, I wouldn't bet on that, Donnie. I just really, really wouldn't. And I don't often, since I've already managed to screw up the YouTube file for the program for this evening, I don't often play Saturday Night Live bits, but God, this was one of the funniest ones I've seen in a long time. A reality television show called Them Trumps. Imagining what it would be like right now, this instant, if the Trump family were African Americans. This was priceless.
Afraid might be over.
Oh, it's not over. Not by a long shot. We'll beat this. Oh, my name isn't Darius Trump.
From the producers of Empire, it's Them Trumps. The first show to ask the question, what if Donald Trump was black? Darius Trump. His wife, Malika. Darius Jr. And Ivanka. Together, they are Them Trumps.
Sir, they know everything. They know about Russia. They know you used campaign money to cover up an affair with Magic City stripper Cinnamon Mercedes. And they know about the pyramid scheme you've been running through your company, Darius Trump Country Hams.
Dad, the media has been out for you since day one, and you prove them all wrong.
That's right. Nobody ever thought you would get this far. The bankruptcies, your baby mamas. But here you are on top.
Yeah. Maybe I've done some dirty thing, but I'm making America great again. And what these feds don't realize is that I'm the president, the most powerful man in the most respected office in the world. They can't lock me up. And even though I may be black.
Freeze, Trump, you're under arrest.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
On the next Them Trumps.
All hail the chief. Woo!
Dad, you're back.
That's right. There's only one rule in America. You can't prosecute a sitting president. It's called checks and balances, baby. And even though I'm black.
You've been impeached.
Yeah, I was waiting on that.
It's got the ring of truth. Because from a comedic standpoint, I kind of look at this as coming from the, can you imagine if Barack Obama had done one-tenth of the shit that this bunch has done, what the Republican Congress would have done? Yeah. Of course, I'm the one who, I don't know, hi gang, I'm the one who suggested that the Trumps were, what was the term I used? Burrow billies. It's kind of the same concept, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, and by the way, Maria Butina of Mother Russia appears to have had a change of heart. Now, she used to swan around with a bunch of Republicans and sort of weaseled her way into the National Ruble Association. But now it looks like she's going to change her not guilty plea to guilty, and she's made a deal. So it depends entirely on the extent to which she sings, but damn, that was interesting. And now, it's not going to be the Ayers guy, and John Kelly just got an apple and a roadmap courtesy of Frederica Wilson of Florida on the way out the door. Oh, man, she burned him to the ground. Talking to the Miami Herald, Representative Wilson said, "I truly thought he would be fired long before now. I think the president was hesitant because of all the publicity that he can't hold staff or he's a bad manager. I think he made it very clear when he was asked by the media over and over, and he said he would never apologize. I think my concern was when he attempted to slander me and to impugn my integrity as a sitting member of Congress when he went to the White House briefing room and actually spoke about it to the American people. I've seen him lose a star every 6 months," talking about him being a four-star general. "It started with me, but there were so many other instances where he was not this man that everyone expected him to be. He lost all of his stars, all four stars, through many more instances that involved racism, misogyny, and immigration. General Kelly needs counseling from a pastor or someone who can help him ask for forgiveness from the nation for all of his insults, not just to me, but to the Dreamers, who he said were lazy, and for his initial support for Rob Porter, accused of domestic violence." Representative Wilson went on to say, "I've received death threats and I've received nooses through the mail. However, I've received so much support from the American people. I've received so much support from the military families, and so has the family of LaDavid Johnson. Maybe some people in America knew who Frederica Wilson was 2 years ago, but 90% of the people know who Frederica Wilson is now." And she's there, and, well, John Kelly's not going to be. Mm-hmm. More ends everywhere. Nor anyone to think. Oh, and by the way, the Secretary of the Veterans Administration? Yeah, you knew this was going to happen sooner or later. Back in 1995, Robert Wilkie, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, delivered a speech in front of a statue of Jefferson Davis at the U.S. Capitol, sponsored by the Daughters of the Confederacy. And he went on to call Jefferson Davis a martyr to the lost cause, an exceptional man in an exceptional age. Yeah. So far, the Department of Veterans Affairs has been, shall we say, reticent about addressing secretary's Confederate past. But the problem is Julius Geezer can't lose too many more members of staff, because he can't find anybody to replace them. And maybe the humiliation of all of that is why he was up this morning twooping about there being no smocking gun. But of all the hilarity that has attended this latest revolving White House door, probably at the top of the list is John Voight saying that he would be open to being chief of staff. You know, John Voight from Deliverance. That John Voight. Caitlin Collins of CNN asked him if he's going to take the open chief of staff job, and he said his credentials are ready. Then David Wright from CNN chimed in and said, you know, people forget that he played the Secretary of Defense in the first Transformers movie back in 2007. Dear God. It really is chaos over there in the White House, isn't it? And that's nothing really to laugh about. The world does not need this level of chaos. Oh, yeah, there's what Greg was talking about. Trump and Pence could both bow down in, go down in unprecedented impeachment. What? Oh, wait. I think I just caused a minor conniption in Connecticut. Darlene writes, why? Angelina Jolie's dad? You fucking kidding me? No, I'm not. He was there today. God knows why. I mean, I guess maybe Trump knows why, but, well. Jesus. But here's the question for anybody saying that, how does Hartman figure that Trump and Pence are going to be convicted in the Senate? You would need every Democratic senator plus 17 Republicans or thereabouts. And you'd probably need one extra Republican just to make up for the fact that Joe Manchin would get it wrong. How do they both get impeached? Oh, Jesus Christ. There's a lot of lack of actual understanding of constitutional processes in this country, I think, which is sad and worrisome. Because apparently there are a lot of people who think, well, if he gets impeached, he leaves. No. It's the conviction in the Senate that determines whether he leaves. And there's nobody who can make Mitch McConnell, I come back to this, who can make Mitch McConnell actually try a bill of impeachment in the Senate. Nobody. Scott in San Diego, Hartman and Senate conviction of Don and Mike. What's in this powdered beet juice drink? Beats the hell out of me. But damn. Okay, back to Baby It's Cold Outside. Michael in Madison says, okay, so I've tried so far to stay out of this whole war on Baby It's Cold Outside, and to be honest, I really don't have a strong opinion on this one way or the other. But Maybe it's just my younger sensibilities, but I thought that Baby Just Go Outside parody sounded like it was written by some real assholes, belittling the idea of consent. I don't know that for a fact, as I'd never heard it until just now and don't know its backstory. But that's the vibe I got from it, a very creepy men's rights activist vibe. Could be. Now, as far as this whole Baby, I saw it on my Facebook feed, and I don't have a lot of right-wingers on it, so I don't know. Now, as far as this whole Baby It's Cold Outside debate goes, when it popped up this year, my reaction was this again, because I don't remember the debate last year, and I actually thought the debate was resolved 2 years ago. Not resolved in the sense that the original song was scrubbed off the face of the earth, but that the problems with the song had been discussed and we'd all moved on, agree or disagree. See, it was 2 years ago that I first heard a discussion of the song in the context of consent. It was in pieces on NPR. Two Minneapolis songwriters rewrote the lyrics and I think actually tried to do something good with it, opening a discussion on issues of consent and raising money for some very necessary causes. Again, I'm not coming down one way or another with regards to the original, nor am I saying this rewrite is an adequate replacement, but it's nice, and I appreciate what this duo was trying to do. Plus, ironically, there's a little bonus right at the end of the song for Scott, because the goddess never sleeps. What was the published date on, Michael asks, on the parody that I played? Let me see here. I'll call it up again. Let's see. This version was done by a guy named Holderness. The Holderness family. Never heard of them before. Might be assholes. But apparently it is of current vintage. It's new. So, for what it's worth. Okay, now let's run over and check out the other version, shall we? Because if there's anything moranical or anything suitable for Moran Monday, it's the Baby It's Cold Outside debate. Here we go.
I really can't stay.
Maybe I'm fine with that.
I've got to go away.
Maybe I'm cool with that.
This evening has been
hoping you'd get home
so
safe.
Very nice.
I'm glad you had a real good time.
My mother will start to worry.
Call her so she knows that you're
and
coming.
And father will be pacing the floor.
Better get your car home.
So really, I'd better scurry.
Take your time.
Should I use the front or back door?
Which one are you pulling towards?
The neighbors
more?
Might think
that you're a real nice girl.
Say, what is this drink?
Pomegranate LaCroix.
I wish I knew how.
Maybe I'll help you
to
out.
Break this spell.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I have to say no, no, no,
you
sir.
You reserve the right to say no.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
You reserve the right to say no.
I really can't stay.
Well, you don't have to.
Ah, but it's cold outside. I've got to get home.
Do you know how to get there from here?
Say, where is my coat?
I'll go and grab it, my dear.
You've really been grand.
We'll have to do this.
Yes,
again.
I agree.
How about the Cheesecake Factory?
We're bound to be talking tomorrow.
Text me at your earliest convenience.
At least I've been getting that vibe.
Lest I catch pneumonia and die.
I'll be on my way.
Thanks for the great night.
Bye.
Bye. Drive safe, please.
Don't watch that episode of Breaking Bad without me.
I won't. I'll save it for you.
Oh, with a little Easter egg there for Scott, a Breaking Bad reference. And yeah, Michael's right. Proceeds of the sale went to Sexual Violence Center of Minnesota and the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. So that's good. And that's got, yeah, that compared to the, yeah, that other version did seem kind of dickish, didn't it? Yeah. And, you know, the other one, they just, well, yeah. That was more musically pleasing. Thanks, Michael. As to the chief of staff stuff, Omarosa apparently told Craig Melvin on MSNBC today that Linda McMahon should be chief of staff. You know, wrestling. Right, that courtesy of Scott in San Diego. That's good. Steve from Georgistan, serious Mitt question. You don't remember Romney's tirade against Trump? He got an hour's worth of TV time trying to tell everyone what a charlatan he was. Don't you think that would figure into Romney's impeachment decision? Nah. Not once you're in the Senate, I don't. Call me cynical, but sorry. Yeah. So that's pretty much more in Monday. Tomorrow will see us with a $635 fundraising goal that doesn't appear to be going anywhere. That's not true. But we got to, at some point, deal with this. Hopefully, maybe the overnight crowd will jump in on it. But, about $600 worth of bills right now. And, you know, I wish, you know, well, we don't have a chimney, so Santa can't drop a big, I wouldn't want him to drop a big bag of money down the chimney anyway, because it would go up in flames. That would be heartbreaking. But listen, as long as things stay lit up here and the packets keep passing, I'm here. And hopefully you will be as well. Thanks to all of you who keep all of this going with your kind contributions. Thank you very, very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky and Steve in the chat room this evening. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thanks, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all. Back tomorrow for Titanic Tuesday.